Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new mini-series, The Docker's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your own unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or a seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Andrew Mohama, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
Today, I'm pleased to be virtually sitting across from Dr. Daniel Bakhter. Daniel Bakhter grew up in Cairo, Egypt, in a multilingual and multigenerational household where French and Arabic were the languages of daily life. When he moved to the United States in 2013 to attend UC Santa Barbara, medicine wasn't even on his radar. But that changed when he joined and later led Doctors Without Walls, a humanitarian group providing free healthcare to people experiencing homelessness. It was this experience that ignited his passion for medicine and set him on a new course. During medical school at Rush Medical College in Chicago, Daniel continued his mission of serving underserved communities by founding Rush Street Medicine, a group dedicated to delivering free healthcare to immigrants and people experiencing homelessness. He also discovered a love for teaching, creating tutoring programs to help students master their shelf exams and step exams. His passion for diagnostic reasoning, medical education, and connecting with patients solidified his path toward internal medicine. Now, as a third-year internal medicine resident at UCSF, Daniel is thriving in one of the best training programs in the world. Daniel also has a distinct interest in studying how and why doctors think the way they do, exploring the cognitive processes that underlie clinical decision-making and diagnostic reasoning. Daniel, welcome to the Doctor's Playbook.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you so much for this very kind introduction that I'm not sure I'm deserving of, but thanks for having me today. Appreciate it. Happy MLK Day.
Happy MLK Day. It's good to have you here. And this is exciting because you were actually last on Alerts and Oriented in 2021. I went and looked back at the clinical case that you helped solve when you were a student at Rush. So I'm sure it feels pretty crazy to be on this side of things now.
Yeah, it was really fun. I think it was one of the first ones that Kevin started. I still remember it was in orthodeoxyplatypnia case, and diagnosis with hepatopulmonary syndrome. It was a really interesting case.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, I was just reviewing it myself this morning. Well, before we dive into some of the specific questions, I just wanted to give you a chance to weigh in. Is there anything else you'd like to say about yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think just to kind of zoom in on the last part, I think most of my clinical interest in medicine that, the main reason I'm saying that is for everyone who's listening, and whether you're like trying to get into med school or like figuring out what to do with your life after med school, research can take many, many different pathways. And I think a lot of people focus on the basic science / like translational science component of medicine. There's like clinical reasoning that you can do. There's clinical training, but you can also do like less conventional things, which is like what I'm trying to do is really trying to understand the cognitive process and the clinical reasoning that goes through a physician's mind from like the moment you see the patient to the process of like trying to go through a differential to the process of like actually putting in the order, and how there's so many different variables that can affect this, from like emotional variables to institutional variables. And it's really, really interesting to like kind of figure out the psyche of the doctor's mind.
Yeah, thanks for expanding on that. I think that's really fascinating and in some ways gets at the heart of what we're trying to do with Doctor's Playbook. And I'm curious how you got to that point where you realized this is something I want to dedicate some time to actually look into.
Yeah, it was a very non-linear process. I think I got into UCSF in intern year. I was, besides the like just really drinking from a fire hose concept, so like trying to figure out how to be a doctor, I was surrounded by truly some of the most intelligent human beings I had ever encountered in my life, and some very accomplished people. And I noticed that everyone was trying to figure out what their purpose was, but also UCSF, one of the lucky things about UCSF is they have someone that is doing something in every single domain that you can think of. And I started making this list of things that, like, quote, like, bug me in medicine that I don't really understand why they're done. And there's a lot of things that are like we do for no reason without really great evidence for, that's just like driven by tradition and dogma and clinical inertia. So I started getting into this domain. I put in a plug here for the Journal of Hospital Medicine. They have these series called Things We Do For No Reason that are really, really interesting and really cool to read. And that's kind of like, I started reading those and then started getting into why we do these things for no reason. And a lot of it is not so much a knowledge deficit. Some of it is, but a lot of it is, it's very hard to change tradition in medicine. It's very hard to change clinical inertia. And even moving the needle a little bit requires a lot more than just introducing knowledge to people.
That's really fascinating. And actually, it makes me think of something that you tweeted at one point. I actually read through some of your tweets in preparation for this interview. And you said at one point, hospital diets for patients are something that often lead to patient frustration and undernutrition, but maybe we do it just because it makes us feel better as doctors. Is that an example of things we maybe do for no reason or for little reason?
Yeah, for little reason. I there are some diets that I think are evidence-based, but they're few and far in between. And I think, if I remember, I think there is a things we do for no reason on neutropenic diets specifically and how they like don't really change any outcomes. But there's a lot of things that are done because they pathophysiologically make sense without really any evidence behind it. I mean, it makes sense to like give someone a diet that has less sugar for someone with diabetes. Like it intuitively makes sense. It just like doesn't change outcomes in the hospital. And I'll ask so far as to say, I think it makes outcomes worse because you don't titrate the insulin, right? Mm. But yeah, there are things like that. And like doing things that are intuitively make sense sometimes is the only option we have because there's like no data on it. But then you sometimes lead to like things that actually make people worse. Like it made sense in the 1970s to not give a beta blocker to someone who had heart failure. It just made sense because like beta blockers decrease inotropy and heart failure is already like a low inotropic state. But then we saw based on data and data and data and years and years and years of practice that actually that was a wrong thing to do, even though it intuitively made sense at the time. So, you know, sometimes we're forced to do it. I understand there's a lot of things that in medicine sometimes are hard to do, but it's kind of fun to reason about it and chat about it on a podcast with you on a Monday morning.
Absolutely. Do you have any thoughts about what might be something, you know, 15, 20, 30 years from now, we may look back on in a similar way and think, you know, that made sense intuitively, but the research or, you know, the evidence shows that we shouldn't actually do that. Do you have any preliminary thoughts on what that could be?
How much time do you have? No, I'm kidding. I'm publishing now a paper on the concept of holding metformin on admission in the hospital. And that's something I learned in med school. It's something that's still done in most institutions in the country by most people. The concept of you admit someone with X diagnosis and they're on metformin at home, you hold all the oral, you know, anti-glycemic agents and titrate insulin sliding scale. And that's just the practice that's been done for years. It's taught to med students, it's taught to residents, and no one really questions it. But there's actually pretty decent data that that's the wrong thing to do in many patients. Not in all patients, but in many patients. And it's not really driven by any data. It's driven by tradition and you know, it's hard to like move the needle. Like the quote is like, yeah, we've been doing this for years. Like there's other things, bigger fish to fry than changing this. And that might be true, but I do think that's one of the things that, you know, there's some data that has shown that it actually worsens outcomes, prolongs hospitalizations, worsens hyperglycemia. And there's also really good data in the endocrine literature that insulin sliding scale is just not the right thing to do, even though everyone in the hospital and near everyone has this ordered on them, including from me as well.
Right.
I'll concede to that. But yeah, I think that's one that's like so unanimous or near unanimous that I think is the wrong thing that we do.
Interesting. We'll have to link to that publication once it's up in our show notes so people can check it out. Yeah, I'd like to ask you, in light of this, in light of these pressures to, you know, go with what's been told for many years, go with tradition, do you have any approach or mantra that helps you maybe fall victim to traditions, even when you know that they may not be the best for patient care? And I'm not necessarily saying directly like prescriptions and like fluids or things like that, but even simple things like how you approach a patient or how you think about, you know, clinical reasoning. Are there mantras that you tell yourself to remind yourself to not give in?
I think there's two things. There's like a two-pronged answer to your question. I think one of them is from a diagnostic reasoning perspective, there's a lot of different theories on clinical reasoning, many of which that I don't know, but I'll give you one of the most popular ones. It's called the theory of planned behavior. It has some of its critics, obviously, because it's not a complete theory, and it does miss a lot of like the cognitive components of clinical reasoning, but it does fit a lot of the things right. So the theory of planned behavior essentially says that all the behaviors that we do are based on like three large components. And it's like, what is the attitude of the person? And when they say attitude, it means like, what is the belief? And that's something like, if we take the metformin example, is how do you feel about ordering metformin in the hospital? Like, what is your knowledge surrounding the data? That's like number one. Once you like settle that, then the next component is, what are the subjective norms around your decision? So you can tell yourself, okay, I'm going to change medicine. I read all the data. I know every single piece of literature about metformin in the hospital. I know that in all these patients, it shouldn't be held. And I can quote the data like the palm of my hand. But then you can say, oh, the subjective norms around me, actually, like most of my peers and co-residents are going to think I'm stupid if I do this. So I don't really want to do that. I don't want to look dumb in front of them. And even if my peers support me, I don't want the attending to think I'm an idiot. So like, not going to do that. Or I don't care if my attending think I'm stupid or not, but like, I don't have the energy to like argue with them on a busy call day. And then even if you get over that, the third component is like, what is your perceived behavior control? So, you know, like you have the right knowledge, you like have the right subjective norms, but like you have no control over this. Like, even if you believe in all this, actually the hospital protocol says that you have to hold metformin on admission, and you can like argue with whoever you want. The protocol says to hold it, and you're kind of like, you're kind of stuck. So I think that I'm saying all this to say, just like doing a bunch of conferences, teaching residents that the right things should be done, or teaching med students the right way, is an important component, but it's only a very small piece of the puzzle. And I think systematic change starts from the top, in the sense that like leadership has to buy in from it. You have to change the way people, you know, think, but also the way people act. And just introducing knowledge to people is not enough.
Wow, that's really interesting. I actually really like that theory of why we think the way we do. And even at my level, as you know, near the end of my third year of medical school, I certainly have fallen victim to all three of those layers. Because I think it's traditionally very difficult to approach this hierarchy of medicine, even with factual knowledge, and try to present it for those who, you know, quote unquote, are above you, to hopefully take it and do something with it, rather than, you know, say, oh, that's just the med student, or oh, that's just the intern, or that's just, you know, they don't know what we've done for many years. Or they may not even, you know, say that, but just brush it off because of your level of training. So I think I'm hopeful that, and I think this is more true in a lot of academic settings, there is a encouragement, like you said, in conferences and teaching, to think outside the box and to think creatively and to think differently. In some places, it might even be celebrated.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
I mentioned Twitter a little earlier from your tweets. I actually saw another thing you mentioned, which I really wanted to ask you about, because I thought it was very interesting. In 2023, you said, AI can certainly help radiologists, but it would be foolish to try replacing them. And then you emphasize the value of walking down to the reading room to discuss cases directly with a radiologist. Can you elaborate a little bit more on this, specifically the irreplaceable human elements that are involved in clinical collaboration? And I think especially in the context of the rapid advancement of AI in medicine.
Yeah, I forgot that I even tweeted that. I still think it, I strongly believe in that statement. I'm actually a big proponent of AI if it's used right in medicine. I'm not even going to pretend that I'm an expert in AI, because I know very little to nothing about it. But I think the concept of replacing physicians is a foolish one. One, because that boils down the physician's role as a pure diagnostician, which I think is very restrictive. It's certainly a very important part of the job that we do, but I think it's only a minor part. And I think to like think about specific examples, there's like specific specialties you can look into. For example, there is a lot of things like when people do primary care clinic that they'll notice that doing the medicine part of things, as in like, here's your like fancy diagnosis with a Latin term, and here's like this medication that you can't pronounce and come back in 3 months, is very, very restrictive in the way we like think about what a physician's role is. There's also the fact of like just talking to another human being, which you'll see a lot in primary care and psychiatry and palliative care medicine, but also in other fields. Like, when someone is about to go to the OR and they're going to undergo a major operation that they've like never experienced before, I bet you 10 times out of 10, they'd rather have their concerns alleviated by a human being rather than a machine. There is a certain component about like the human interaction and sharing of emotions that is so important to the physician-patient relationship that I don't think can be replaced. Do I think that AI can come in and come up with a 15 problem differential better than a physician? Absolutely. There's no doubt about this. They're faster than how we think, and they can pull in data from many more references than a human brain can ever think about. But we don't really need that as doctors. First, because there's one skill to know a certain number of diagnoses. There's another one to know what to do with this list. You can give like a list of 10 people to someone who's not trained in medicine. They won't know what to do with it. They'll have no idea what to do with it. I think the investment we spend in medical school and residency and fellowship is not so much to like come up with diagnoses, but it's like how to reason through the process. And the correct diagnosis doesn't always have the correct treatment. You have to also take into consideration social factors that come into like play. So I think AI will certainly help us in getting information faster from like different resources and catching mistakes. But I don't think it'll ever replace us in a way.
I think that's a great answer. And I would say I'm actually in total agreement, especially your point on, you know, the human element of delivering diagnoses, delivering treatment plans to patients. I mean, I think anyone listening, if you've been to the doctor at all, I guarantee you, you don't remember the details of every treatment plan they offered you or even the name of diagnoses, but you certainly remember the look on their face, the way you felt in that room, the, you know, maybe even the lighting in that room and things that are very uniquely human. And to me, that's what's so exciting about clinical reasoning is it doesn't exist on its own in a vacuum. It exists in the context of directly affecting human health and quality of life, which is why to me, like my favorite people to work with or those who have been the most inspirational to me are the ones who can combine a really impressive intellectual knowledge of medicine, but then translate that into wisdom, which is the act of applying that knowledge to the human life. And the way they do that with such emotional intelligence and awareness and competence, it's really been impressive to me. And it actually reminds me of Dr. Richard Abrams, who was on this series on our most previous episode. And he talked a lot about the human element, and it's what's kept him excited about medicine for 40 years of practice as an internist in the hospital. Switching gears again, I want to go to some things that you might have thought about when you advise people. You know, you're in a position now in your third year of internal medicine residency where you're directly training residents. You're probably working with medical students as well. And I'm sure in some of your research, you have teams that you are advising as well. So in general, what advice would you give people, you know, whether they're medical students or residents, about honing in their clinical reasoning skills?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. The one thing that I always tell people, and I refer to Atul Gawande's The Checklist Manifesto. If you haven't read it, I think it's a must in medicine. But the concept of frameworks and checklists is crucial in medicine. And I think it's very different than protocols. So for example, I'm a strong proponent of letting physicians really clinically reason and use their training to be able to come up with diagnoses and not be restricted by a certain institutional protocol. However, physicians are humans and humans make mistakes. And that's where frameworks and checklists and steps to follow is crucial. So for example, the example I always give interns or interns that are about to become seniors, a lot of the question I get is, oh my God, how do I run a code? And everyone learns the ACLS algorithm. If you put them in a classroom, everyone will tell you when to give epinephrine and when to do compressions and what's time interval and all these things. But you put this same brilliant person in a room of 30 people with nurses and pharmacists and other doctors, everyone yelling, and the family screaming, and the patient doesn't have a pulse, and they look terrible, and then you lose your knowledge very, very quickly. Like the colloquial like brain fart, right? And this is when resorting to a simple checklist or a simple framework becomes very, very helpful. And I don't think there's any time where you don't feel stressed in medicine. And I think if you do, then there is a certain question about if you should still be in medicine, because I think stress is important if it's used correctly. But what I teach people, to get back to your point, in clinical reasoning is you should have a framework that you build your reasoning on. So for example, you should have a checklist of what you do when you go on a code. You should have a framework on how to approach dyspnea in the hospital. You should have a a framework on how to approach chest pain. And then you can spread your wings and divert from it, but you should always have something to go back to. I think part of the issue is that medicine has swung both ways. Early on, it was physicians are the all-knowing beings. They know everything, and giving them a way to think is restrictive and insulting. And I think that's obviously the wrong answer. And then I think the pendulum swung the other way, where we should have a protocol for everything and we should minimize as much as we can the ability of human error. And that's also wrong because, you can only predict 90-some percent of the scenarios. So I think there has to be a balance in between where we're able to set up a checklist or a framework to avoid those silly mistakes, the mistakes that Togwan did, calls in the book, the stupid stuff. And then we should have the ability to use our training to use all these lessons that you learn to divert a little bit from that framework.
I think that's really good advice. I think I take that to heart as well. I mean, I'm so early on in my clinical exposure in medical school, and I think I've heard different semblances of that advice told to me as well. And yeah, having something you can rely on amid all of the muckiness of medicine at times sounds very helpful. And then I guess in line with, error, you mentioned human error, and you think about your intern year, I'm sure there are many times, and I'm sure still, where you find yourself, having a mistake or misstepping or forgetting something. So I'm curious if you could you share a favorite failure from your medical journey, something that maybe at first felt like a setback, but ultimately shaped you into a better clinician.
I have a lot of different failures. The one that comes to mind was an intern year, and the moral of that story is the patients don't read textbooks. So we had this guy come in. He was in his mid-60s or so, looked good, was having a little bit of nausea. The ED appropriately got an EKG and it was fine. And then his troponin was high and we're like, okay, fine, whatever. We'll just keep trending the troponin. There's probably something else going on. And we trend it and it keeps going up. And we ask him, do you have chest pain? And he's like, no. We trend it and it keeps going up. Do you have chest pain? No, 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 no. And we keep trending. And we're all saying, and I'm the first one saying, listen, this cannot be ACS. This guy cannot be having an NSTEMI right now. He looks great. His EKG looks fine. And the classic thing in medicine is ACS, you need to have the three things. You need to have the patient presentation, you need to have the EKG changes, and you need to have the biomarkers. And he only had the biomarkers, and the biomarkers are nonspecific. So I was very much anchored on the fact that this can't be it, and we kept moving on. I guess you can tell where I'm going with this story, but his troponin kept going up, and his nausea just started getting worse. Never had any chest pain. And we consulted cardiology, and the fellow was like, you guys, this is totally NSTEMI. How'd you guys miss that? They took him to the cath lab, and he had an obstruction in his left circumflex. And, I think it's important to learn, criteria and the black and white presentations in med school. You have to have that. But it's equally as important, I learned from this, that criteria is based on most people presenting with that symptom. And I use most and not everyone, because there's people that divert from that. So I think anchoring bias is probably one of the worst things in medicine. Confirmation bias is a second close. And if something doesn't make sense, don't try to make it make sense. Ended up being fine because the cardiology fellow was brilliant and she caught it right away.
That's great. That's the power of teamwork, I suppose. Yeah, well, thanks for sharing that story. I can't imagine any person in medicine who doesn't have some similar experience where they look back to when they see patients about a time they may be anchored on something. It happens as early as the first week of medical school when you're learning preclinical curriculum all the way up until, I'm sure, the very end of the physician's career. So yeah, I it reminds me of a comment that Kevin made on the podcast a couple episodes ago. He said, don't reason in isolation. And he's very strong on that. It's something that he would want to put on a metaphorical billboard if he could, about things to healthcare workers, because when you reason in isolation, you can often anchor, you can often get lost, and you can lead yourself astray. So when you reason out loud with your team, when you're willing to say, I don't understand this, or I don't believe this is to be true, but what are your thoughts? That's when we can catch things. So by you guys consulting cardiology, that's how you caught this, and the patient ultimately was okay. So in terms of your own residency training, Daniel, 3 years of internal med can be a very rigorous training and you can learn a lot. So I'm curious to know, has there been any new beliefs behavior habits that you believe in the last 3 years of your training and residency has, I guess, best helped your practice as a resident physician and soon to be post-internal med physician?
Yeah, there's quite a lot. The first one that comes to mind is something that I was just thinking about yesterday, actually. So in June, I'm going to be one of the chief residents at UCFSF, which means that you also attend on service, which means that, you know, the seniors and the interns and the med students and even the patients kind of look to you as what ends up being like, quote, the like final word, right? But I learned that it's not the final word. And that's what I'm trying to get at is so many times in residency, when I was admitting someone at night with, you know, and I didn't know what to do with this, or the presentation was weird. Like, is it COPD? Is it pneumonia? Is it like cardiac wheeze? Is that heart failure? The best answers I got both medically, but also from a therapeutic standpoint, was actually talking it through with like my co-residents and using brain power from like-minded people and this kind of like riding the same ship as you to like help you through the process. And that's like also what was most fun about residency is when you're like, hey, like you come up to your friend, you're like, hey, can I talk to you about a case real quick? Like you don't have to go to an expert or like someone who's like a leader in the field. Like a lot of my colleagues really helped me through things and ultimately ended up helping my patients. So I guess the advice I would give for people going into residency who are scared of like becoming the doctor, residency, I think has been, I thought med school was the best years of my life. I think residency maybe trumps that a little bit, but both 7 years were amazing. And I will say it's okay to like not know, and it's actually expected for you to not know. What is expected for you to lean on people like your co-residents and your colleagues to help you through it, because it's shocking how helpful it is.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Well, first, congratulations on the chief residency. That's going to be very exciting. And I'm sure you'll be loved at your institution just based on your mindset and your approach to clinical reasoning and teamwork. You'll make an excellent chief resident. And second, it's very refreshing to hear that residency can, you know, that it just keeps getting better and better. I feel like medical school for myself, it, you know, started kind of low and then it kept getting better and better and better. And I've loved third year clinical rotations, and I'm very much looking forward to fourth year. You know, I'm planning to apply into internal medicine. So it just gets exciting. You can get more focused on what you love and care about. And I'm sure that residency, despite its intensities, you're doing what you want to do. And that's, I guess that sounds exciting. So glad to hear. Now, as you think about going into your chief year, and I guess think about just the future of medicine in general, is there something specifically about, you know, say the next 5, 10, 15 years of practice that excites you most about the future of medicine or clinical reasoning? You know, you can answer this in really any realm. It can be directly related to internal medicine. It can be just about the field in general. What's something that you're excited about, looking forward to?
Yeah, actually, it goes back to what you asked me earlier about AI. I think if AI is used right, it can be one of the most exciting tools we've had at our disposal as physicians. I think if you ask, I'm going to make a generalization here, but if you ask almost any physician what the worst aspect of their job is, many of which are going to say it's like the documentation, non-patient care, not clinical aspect of medicine. It's what takes the longest. It's what requires the most cognitive load on you. And it's the thing we're not trained in at all that we all hate. And I think one other aspect of AI, besides helping us to like reason through things, is to take these things off our hand, you know, like the note writing, like the filling out this documentation, like to fill out these forms and things like that. And I think from an emotional perspective, most physicians would appreciate that. From a financial perspective, it also makes sense to do that, because then your time is freed up to see more patients and to actually help more people. So I actually am really looking forward to AI. I'm very much hoping that it is used in the right way to assist physicians and not replace them. And I think in the next 10 years are going to be very interesting in medicine because of like this like revolution that's happening right now.
Yeah, I would agree. I share the same thoughts. I was pretty shocked when I went into rotations and I saw just how much behind the scenes work there is to do the job of a resident or of a physician. It almost was upsetting in some ways. I mean, I was like, for every, you know, say 5 minutes of patient care, the resident would spend, you know, 30 minutes at least, you know, putting in orders, putting in notes, like sending messages. And, you know, there's a sense of fulfillment out of taking care of those things as well. But I agree that I can't imagine the amount of freed up time there would be if AI can assist us with that. And, you know, currently I'm in my primary care clerkship, and last week in clinic, I'm at a Southside Community Health Clinic in Englewood, Chicago. They're piloting AI-assisted documentation. And the physician, she's, you know, towards the end of her career as a family medicine physician, was literally jumping up and down in excitement when she saw the note that it created. Just by setting her phone down next to her and the patient, when she asked them about everything, she did the physical exam and vocalized what she, you know, was seeing in the physical exam, went back to her office, and in less than 1 minute, it had created an HPI, a beautiful physical exam, and a plan with step-by-step details to be perfectly picked up on next time you see the patient. And it was just a fun experience. I don't think I'll forget that, because that was the first time I saw in action AI assist a note in its entirety, and the way a, you know, physician, like just how they jumped up and down in excitement about that experience. Now, Daniel, you clearly have so many fascinating insights and knowledge inside of medicine, but I'm curious about your life outside of medicine. You know, what inspires you or kind of helps keep you grounded in life? Because I think in medicine, it's clearly, you know, intensive career, and we can pour all of ourselves into it. But what outside of medicine is keeping you whole?
I'm an avid video gamer. I always thought that video games was for children. And then I kept growing up and kept playing video games. And I'm like, either I'm still a child or adults are playing video games now. I think it's a mixture of both. But yeah, I love playing video games. It's also, I feel like, a way to connect with, you know, people that are not geographically around me that I can still like connect with. And I'm also a huge soccer fan. I've been following this terrible team now, unfortunately, called Manchester United since I was like 5 years old back in Egypt, and have gone through many ups and downs with them, mainly a lot of downs in the past decade or so. But I think those are the two things that, you know, bring me joy outside of medicine. I also love reading, although most of the stuff that I read is somehow like peri-medicine related. But I will say I've noticed in residency or in medicine in general, people are like so well-rounded, but also people are so different. And that's like what's really cool about medicine. People have like so many different hobbies and things like that. So whatever you do, I feel like you're never too busy to do your hobby. And to hear from someone who's like in residency, sometimes you are too busy, but like not for long. Like you can still find time to do it.
That's great. Yeah, thanks for sharing. I hope you have more success with your soccer team in the future. And you know, gaming is, I loved gaming growing up. I sadly haven't been playing it as much in medical school because I didn't bring a system with me. But I miss it because, like you said, the interaction with other people is, it's a bonding experience. I mean, you're all playing something, doesn't even matter what you're playing, but you could be sitting there talking with your friends or with people from around the world. And, you know, one of my research interests is loneliness and social isolation and how that impacts our health. And in my research of that topic, gaming has come up as a way that people feel connected to the world. They feel connected to their friends, to different communities. So I'm fascinated by that. So it's cool to hear that you're into that and still finding time for it. And to finish this conversation, is there anything else you'd like to say to people listening, people who have an interest in clinical reasoning, people who have an interest in medicine, or just more broadly speaking, the experience of being a doctor? Anything else you'd like to share?
Yeah, I'm thinking now of like the smartest physicians I've worked with, or the people that I look up to the most, and even med students that I teach or interns. And I'm thinking of the ones that I like really liked working with. And it's never the ones that know the most. It's never the ones that, like, you know, can come up with the answer the quickest or like can come up with the longest differential. Obviously that's great. And if you can do that, that's amazing and you should keep doing it. But I feel like what really saves you in medicine and what really makes you a good doctor is your attitude. I know it sounds cliche, but I'll give you an example. When I'm senioring on wards and soon when I become an attending, and soon when you as med students or early learners become doctors, we all interact with very smart people just by virtue of like the field we've chosen to do. And I think, you know, the what I always tell med students when I start rotations is you don't need to know the answer. You don't need to have like the most brilliant differential, but you need to have a learning attitude. So I look now to like some of the smartest physicians I've worked with, and it's the ones that even when they're like expert diagnosticians, they still come to you and say like, hey, I heard you talk to this derm resident. Hey, can you teach me what they said? And you're an intern and they're asking you to do that. When someone asks them in conference something and they don't know the answer and they say, I don't know. even though they're expert diagnosticians. And I found it that the one thing that has changed me the most in residency is you can never be truly an expert in something. You can be extremely knowledgeable about it, but there's just one patient who's going to trick you into thinking about something wrong. And that's okay. That's what makes medicine so fun. But I think that the thing that our saving grace when we're tired, when we're exhausted, when we're just emotionally burnt out, the saving grace is to always realize that, like, there's always more to learn. You're never going to know everything. Clinical reasoning is interesting because I don't think clinical reasoning means knowing the most. I think it's just wiring your brain to always ask why. When you get the classic COPD admission and it's like, oh, this smoker for 45 years and he's come for COPD 3 times and he always comes in with this, you can reflexively just start him on NEBS, start him on prednisone, start him on antibiotics for 5 days, send him home and just go through the motion. Or you can ask why. Why is this person keep coming in? What's happening at home that makes them always come in? And why is what we're doing not working for them? And that's how I think you reason through like deeper answers that are like hidden behind the surface. And you can almost ask this question for every admission or problem you get in the hospital. So as hard as it is sometimes, be humble in asking. Everyone can teach you something in medicine. And ask why, and when you've asked why, ask why again.
Thanks again for listening. Person, time, and place. We'll see you next time.